You're listening to Radio Freethinker, and this is Southern Man.
That's over now because the show just started. Hello and welcome to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan. I am your freethinking historian. Of course, I'm joined by Don.
Hello, Don, the philosopher of political science, and Ethan. Elon.
My name's Elon, not Ethan, and I'm back, and I'm the freethinking computer scientist.
And my name is Rob, and I'm a cognitive psychologist and wealthy.
Well, that was our smoothest opening ever. Okay, so someone please tell me what happened this day in history.
Well, I got two things related to this day in history that I think are quite interesting. In 1966, the Vatican announced the abolition of the Index of Prohibited Books, which was instituted in 1557. So things like Galileo and all that, Catholics were allowed to read.
I read banned books.
Also, in 1846, Pope Pius IX was elected. He's the longest-serving pope in history, and he has a lot of things that he's quite famous for. One of them, least important perhaps, he lost the Papal States. Up until that point, the pope was not only leader of the church, but also leader of an actual state in Italy. He also created the dogma of papal infallibility, so whatever the pope said has to be true.
Can we get one of those for us?
You could.
We already do, actually. There's a religion called Discordianism in which the two tenets basically are that, one, everybody is a pope of Discordianism, and two, all popes of Discordianism are completely infallible, even retroactively. So there you go.
But I think you've made a mistake there, and if I'm infallible, then that has to be true.
Well, we can have both.
He's also...
If we say something that contradicts each other,
then we...
And the world explodes.
We move into a special logical universe called Tertullian's world, where everything and its counterpart are true.
Let's just make it clear. This is a joke religion, everybody.
Yes, we are not actually Discordians.
True. Going on contradiction, actually, there's an interesting contradiction. When the Pope actually lost his state, he also created a thing called the Syllabus of Errors, which put the church firmly into political things. It condemned communism and all that. But I think one of his most famous one was the creation of the dogma of the Immaculate Conception, i.e. the virgin birth. Now, of course, people believed in the virgin birth before that, but he actually defined it and put it into religious dogma at that point.
I remember in Bill Maher's movie Religious, he made a funny comment about this whole idea of the Immaculate Conception, that it's not actually mentioned in the Bible, apparently, and sort of just a dogma. And if the Bible is supposed to be this like written account of like Jesus and they're telling all about his life, sort of, you'd think that would have been an interesting sort of tidbit that they would have put in. Like, if you're a journalist, you'd might be like, oh, by the way, Jesus was born from a virgin. It's like, seems like something a bit interesting.
Yeah, I actually ran into this in Whistler some years ago.
A virgin birth?
No. I was visiting friends of the family, and it was around Christmas time, and I went with them to a Catholic church for Christmas Mass. And the sermon the priest was giving basically was saying that, you know, we know that the virgin birth happened, that you know, science tells us that virgin birth is impossible, but we know that it happened and that it was possible because the Bible told us so. No, it didn't.
Well, doubly so, because, I mean, most religious scholars now who seriously look at the Bible say that the word virgin that appears in the English Bibles is actually a mistranslation, and the original text meant a young girl who could have been a virgin. I mean, it doesn't rule it out, but doesn't explicitly say that she woke up one day going, what the hell happened to me?
Well, it is an interesting theological debate. I'm just going to interrupt things now because I want to remind our listeners that today, Tuesday the 16th, at 6:30 at the Railway Club, we have Café Scientifique. The topic is infectious biology with speakers Drs. Kevin Jacobson, Laura Sly, and Bruce Vallis at the Railway Club, 6:30 in Vancouver.
They're going to talk about really fun things like infectious diseases of the gut, irritable bowel syndrome, and possibly even some fun parasites.
Well, it'll be great. We'll all be there, so come out and check things out. And now I'm going to talk about something that just happened in the news. It's actually a bit of a continuation of previous topics. So probably you've all heard this. On June 10th, an 88-year-old man went into the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum with a gun and shot a security guard before he was, you know, subdued. The accused in this case is a white supremacist with a history of violent anti-Semitism and is also the second shooting motivated by irrational violent ideology, the first being the murder of George Tiller. It's also the second time white supremacists have come into the news. We spoke a few weeks ago about the family in Manitoba raising their children to be white supremacists and how the government took that child away. We even received an email about the issue, and we spoke about how the state has a duty to protect society as a whole from violent cloistered groups. And we mentioned living in a society requires us to give up certain individual liberties, in this case, hate speech, or as we termed it, intellectual abuse. And this is kind of getting what Don was saying, confronting the slippery slope.
Exactly. You know, where do you define things? But there are some things I think are beyond the pale, and this is one of those good cases.
Yeah. And
well,
as
good.
It demonstrates the situation. I mean, as skeptics, I think that we have a job to point out the just irrationality of these conspiracy theories, this virulent racism that permeates society, and sort of leaving it alone is not a good method for dealing with it. I think that it's a good example of why hate crimes and why we incitement to violence is, you know, illegal here.
Well, it's also, too, I mean, the government officials, I mean, they'd been following this guy. This guy wasn't from out of nowhere. They knew who he was, what he was. Obviously, they didn't know what he was planning. They refer to this term lone wolf sort of mentality. And, yeah, I mean, you sit there and you have to, there's a scales, but you sit back and you say, this guy's been doing this, and free speech is good. But again, in the United States, it's unlimited. In Canada, we sit there and we say there are limits to free speech where some things you can say are harmful to society.
Exactly. And I think that's the case that this demonstrates, is that you have to have barriers, because if you let this kind of hate speech format, it brings out these kind of people. And then they go and do something really, really tragic like this.
Well, and to add on to that, the guy who shot Tiller, the doctor in Wichita.
Scott Roeder.
Roeder or whatever, right?
Yeah.
He himself wasn't so big of a person in anything, but he was incited. There was he had an associate with a guy named David Leach, who runs a newspaper that promotes this kind of hate speech. So again, you know, even if you don't do it, the speech itself can inspire others to do those kind of things.
I don't, like, one thing though, I don't know if necessarily the solution is to decrease the free speech. I guess it's a really complicated topic. Like,
I think it's a tricky, tricky problem, and I'm not sure simple censorship is going to do
it
much.
Seems like more if you could just really vilify certain things, like, sort of like if someone is a completely different topic, obviously, a different example, but like, let's say someone is like someone who believes in some silly thing like homeopathy or whatever, and he's a doctor, and he's, you know, or whatever, and if he's saying, if he's a doctor, it's different, but someone's saying something like kind of crazy, instead of sort of saying that's illegal, you shouldn't say that, you just sort of like say on the radio, this guy's crazy, this guy's saying things that are ridiculous, and if you sort of like make it so that the society will not respect someone who has these thoughts, I guess that's the case with racism.
There actually is a professor here at UBC, his name is Andrew something, I quite forget, but he teaches law and philosophy, and he does actually have some published papers and some columns in some local papers about free speech and what should be censored, what should be allowed to be heard, and he seemed to be in favor of letting hate speech be heard in all its forms, but dealing with it carefully and immediately.
Well, I mean, that's well and good, but
I have to find him and read this, though.
We could interview him. We have the issue. I mean, we had a family in Manitoba instilling in their child white supremacy, and they went to class and spread this around. I mean, you have to, at some point, you have to say, okay, this child is actually dangerous now.
Well, I think we're missing a thing, and I think it'll cover up some of the issues, is the idea of there are some things that are sacred cows that you cannot, forgive my use of that term, there are some things you just don't want to talk to. So in the United States, free speech, you have absolute free speech no matter what. Well, no, you should look at what people are saying and deal with it.
Well, they say you have absolute free speech.
Yes, conspiracy theory number. But, no, so you should be able to review something with that. Children, do you have absolute right to teach your children anything you want? Well, we should look at it with a skeptical eye and say, listen, you know, let's see what's being taught and is it good or is it bad and make an assessment. Religion, you know, you should be able to look at religious topics and say, well, they're not different kinds of truth. They're not different spheres. Everything should be open to a critical eye and say, listen, is this good or is this bad? And giving as much leeway as you can for diversity, but saying there are boundaries that we shouldn't cross.
I think it comes down to how you want to define what free speech is and how you want to deal with it when it looks like it's getting out of hand, which is something that I think we need to look at more data before we can really make any policy decisions about.
So this murderer, the guy who went into the Holocaust Museum, did he give a specific reason as to why he was doing it, or was it just in general, like, Jews are horrible?
As a symbolic...
Well, he has written a book in the past, I believe something like Kill All the Gentiles, and he's belonged to several white supremacist, anti-Semitic clubs or...
Well, he's actually a member or former member associated with a group called the Montana Freemen. Now, people might remember that name because the Scott Roeder, the guy who shot Tiller, is also an associate with Montana Freedmen. And he had said, actually, in an interview on Monday before the shooting, that this was going to be one of a series of events put on by this sort of theocratic anarchist-type group. And lo and behold, on Wednesday, the Holocaust shooting occurred. And there was another shooting, actually, that had occurred, I think it was in April, where another associate of this group shot three cops in the United States. I'm not sure exactly when the time was, but it was earlier this year.
Well, if it turns out that Montana Freedmen is behind all of these shootings? You heard it here first.
Right. Well, we should be getting into a commercial. So if our listeners want to write in and talk about this as well, please email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com, and we'll be right back after this.
Okay, hello. I'm Tim Gain. And you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to Radio Free Thinker. We're just about to air an interview with Chris French, the director of the Anonymous Psychology Research Unit at Goldsmiths University in the UK.
Where did you meet him?
At Goldsmiths University in the UK. I went there in my little holiday, and here's an interview with him. So you're the director of the APRU here at Goldsmiths University and also the editor of the Skeptic magazine.
That's right.
Could you tell us a little about your duties as head of these organizations?
Okay. Well, the Anomalistic Psychology Research Unit was founded, I think it was 2000, basically to kind of provide a focus for my own research and kind of collaborators and so on. I should say what anomalistic psychology is, because obviously most people have never even heard the phrase before. Anomalistic psychology basically is the psychology of weird experiences and paranormal beliefs and related types of phenomena. And the general approach is to say, well, can we explain these things in non-paranormal terms? So that usually means in terms of human psychology. And, I mean, the short answer is yes, a lot of the time we can. I wouldn't say that anomalistic psychology can provide definitive answers to explain away every single kind of ostensibly paranormal experience. But we've made remarkably good progress. I mean, it's a very specialised discipline, obviously, but it's one that is expanding. There are more and more universities up and down the country that are putting on courses in this area. One of the developments that I am really very excited about is the fact that as from September, anomalistic psychology will be an option on the A-level syllabus in the UK, which means that thousands and thousands of kids every year will be reading about this stuff. And hopefully that will be a really good tool to get across the ideas of critical thinking, of looking at evidence, of realising that personal experience often isn't the best guide. I mean, you know, it's a very natural belief for people to say, well, I believe in UFOs or I believe in ghosts if I saw one with my own eyes. No, that's not good enough. Yeah, we know from human psychology that people can think they see all kinds of things, memory can be distorted, and it's those kind of factors that we tend to concentrate on. So we've basically been publishing papers on our own research in psychology journals. I've been on a bit of a personal campaign to try and raise the academic respectability of the area, because even though you may go around with the word skeptic virtually tattooed across your forehead, you can still get the attitude from some people of, why are you interested in that weird stuff? And now, the reason to be interested is because most people, you look at opinion polls and the vast majority of the population, do believe in this stuff. And if we as psychologists have nothing to say about it, we're missing out on a very important part of human experience. So, you know, it's there, it's growing. I'm really pleased with the progress that's been made. Obviously, it's not just my unit. There are people around the world. There's Jim Alcock in Canada, who was reading his book many, many years ago that got me into this area in the first place. Obviously, people like Ray Hyman, Richard Wiseman, Sue Blackmore. All these people have made tremendous contributions, and as I say, the whole thing is growing, so that's just great.
Talking of Richard Wiseman, I think you and he just did a test of a psychic as part of the JREF challenge.
We did indeed, yeah. It's always interesting doing those things. The first time I'd ever actually, I mean, I've known Richard for years, it's the first time we'd actually worked together on something. And he's a great guy, he's always good fun to be with. I mean, the whole JREF challenge, the idea there, as I'm sure all your listeners will know, is that the James Randi Educational Foundation has $1 million on offer to anyone who can prove under control conditions that they have psychic ability. But not unreasonably, James insists on a preliminary test being carried out, which must be passed before people go for the formal challenge. So what Richard and I were doing was the preliminary test of a British psychic called Patricia Putt.
Just a note to our listeners, we have a three-part interview with James Randi. You can find that in our archives.
It would be well worth listening to. He always is. I'll just give a plug here for the Skeptic magazine. The next issue, we also have an interview with James Randi, which should be going up on our website. He's always very, very interesting to listen to. Back to the nature of the test. What we did, we got Patricia to come in and essentially to do 10 readings for different volunteers. When all the readings had been done, then she claims she's talking to the spirits and the information is coming to her about these people in terms of their lives, their personalities, their interests, etc. After she had done all her readings, no communication, no speaking aloud, etc., the volunteers all came back, and the test was that if 5 or more out of the 10 of them could correctly identify the reading that had been done for them, then she would be deemed to have passed the test. Unfortunately for Patricia, she scored a great big zero. Not one person picked the actual reading that had actually been done for them. Initially, she took it very well, which is quite unusual in my experience. When you test psychics, they typically start to make excuses for why it wasn't a fair test almost immediately. In Patricia's case, it took maybe a day or two before she started doing that. But sure enough, she subsequently decided that the test, she was bound to fail. It wasn't a fair test after all. And this, unfortunately, is just all too typical of psychics. When they take tests which they have helped to design, they have agreed to the conditions, they have signed a statement to that effect before you start, it's only when they fail that they suddenly decide that the conditions weren't fair after all.
Could you tell us a little about the magazine, The Skeptic?
I will, gladly. The Skeptic magazine is, in fact, just coming to a very important birthday. We've just been around for 21 years, so we're to mark our coming of age. The Skeptic magazine is going from 28 pages to 40 pages. We're working on the first revamp issue as I speak. We basically... I've got lots of new columnists on board. We want to increase the number of subscribers. So any of your listeners that are interested in taking out subscriptions, it's www.skeptic, with a K, needless to say, .org.uk. And we've got lots of, we've got an interview with James Randi in the next edition. Interview with Sue Blackmore in the issue after that. We've got articles coming along from Richard Wiseman, Ray Hyman. We've put together an editorial board, editorial advisory board, and one of the really gratifying things was that virtually everyone we asked, including most of the really huge names in skepticism, immediately said yes, wanted to be on board and wanted to help out. So the future's looking good for the Skeptic magazine. That's the UK Skeptic magazine, not to be confused with a certain other publication known as Skeptic, which is also very good.
And before we go, do you have some advice you can give to our listeners who want to learn more about the psychology of anomalous events and become more skeptical?
By all means. I mean, one reasonable place to start would be our own website, which is www.goldsmiths.ac.uk/APRU for Anomalistic Psychology Research Unit. And if your listeners go to that website, they can download various publications, they can sign up for our Psychology of the Paranormal email list. There are basically, you know, the descriptions of the kinds of things that we do. They can take part very often in online experiments, etc., etc. They can also get details. I teach a course here as part of our psychology degree program on anomalistic psychology, and all of the lecture handouts are available there with reading lists, etc., etc. So I think that's as good a place as any to start, and obviously there's lots of links to other websites.
All right. Thank you very much, Chris French.
Thank you.
This Saturday, grab your toga and a pair of sandals. June is Greek Heritage Month, and the Hellenic Canadian Congress of BC invites you to dress like Zeus and celebrate the finale, Greek Day, a one-day street festival taking place on Broadway, sponsored by Crino's Foods. The annual event attracts thousands of attendees, many in costume and all having a great time. Visit www.greekday.com for a full schedule of events, and let Greek heritage be your discovery on June 21st.
Hello, this is Rebecca Watson, creator of Skeptic and co-host of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast, and you're listening to Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
The following takes place between the hours of 4:20 and 4:30 p.m.
That was our homage to the television show 24, because in this segment we're going to be talking about myths in TV dealing with technology, things that they present to us on shows such as 24, CSI, shows like that, that aren't actually the real state of the art of what we're capable of doing right now with computers.
What, myths? No, it has to be real. They couldn't put it on TV if it wasn't real.
Well, but this is a little different. Like, obviously you have shows like Star Trek or whatever where they're flying around the galaxy, and those they're presented as fake.
But clearly science fiction.
Yeah, so the, like, I'm going to give some examples of things that happened on 24, which is a show I watched this past season of, which some of the people that were are hosting the show with me glare at me for doing so.
I haven't even seen any.
Well, just before you get into that, sorry, just let's cover that one topic. It's fiction. So, I mean, why is it important that it if they make stuff up or not?
Well, in my opinion, it's just if you're making a show that you're presenting what are we capable of doing, you know, although it's supposed to be a realistic aspect of the show, it's confusing people, and people don't actually know what the real science is. So it's sort of like either make a show that's completely science fiction or make a show or make some announcement that it's not real. But anyways, let's go into an example.
Well, I was going to say, actually, because I was baiting you there, one good example is the O.J. Simpson trial, which is old news these days, but people had a misunderstanding of genetics and someone went free. And where did they get the misunderstanding?
Based
they
on
watched
TV.
Watched TV.
Yeah. You watch a lot of CSI, and I bet that when CSI came out, there was a huge influx of new students to forensic science classes, and they didn't know what the hell they were doing because they were basing their opinion of what forensic science was on.
Well, actually, I did
fiction.
Hear.
So we need to have a critical eye, even on fictional things, just
well,
so we don't get
let's get to some of these examples here.
Example.
All right. So I'm in computer science. I'm going to focus on some computer science-related things. So the first one that I want to talk about is this zoom-in and enhance technology that they seem to have on a lot of these TV shows. So basically how this works is on the show, they have some blurry, faraway image of something that, like a scene, and they need to find something that happened, a very detailed thing that happened in the scene. So what they do is they zoom in on the image until it's very clear and they can see.
Like someone's face or a license plate number.
Right. So being in computer vision, actually, which is the study of, like, image processing and image understanding, this is absolutely impossible. And the reason for this is that an image is information. You have a certain amount of information in an image, and you can't create more information than what's there. So every pixel in the image, you could think of it as like a value representing the color of that pixel. And when you zoom in on your software at home, what you're doing is you're taking the averages of these pixel values and you're sort of interpolating It's, well, whatever. It's not important. But the thing is, what you're not doing is creating new information to figure out. So if a face is blurry in your image, you can't zoom into the image and get a clear vision of the face if it's not there to begin with.
You actually zoom in and you get an even blurrier image because the pixels are bigger.
But having said that, there are kernels of truth to that, because there was this case of a pedophile who had took pictures with himself and he blurred his own image. But he did that digitally. And what they did is they could undo the blur, but they weren't doing this science fiction zoom in thing. They were just undoing the information that was already there.
If they could figure out what's the algorithm he used to blur the image, then they could apply a reverse or an inverse of that operation in order to get back the original information. That's sort of like the whole idea of, like, when you're encrypting or decrypting your files. That's very different than just having your original raw data and then enhancing it.
So there's
like a huge amount of episodes of CSI, for example, that the plot almost completely relies on zooming in and enhancing an image. And actually, recently, CSI had an episode, their 200th episode, where it looked like they were trying to make the science a little more believable. And they actually have one scene in there where Lawrence Fishburne is looking over Archie's shoulder as he's zooming in on this picture. And it actually stays blurry, if not gets more blurry. And they're sitting there looking, what is that? And he's like, I can't actually get any better than that. And it's like, wow, they actually tried being more accurate there. Unfortunately, this episode is one of the lowest rated episodes of CSI, so it's possible that, you know, they clean up the science behind this to make it more zippy,
more
exciting, you know, more interesting to watch, as opposed to people going, well, I don't know.
Well, this segment isn't even really to condemn these shows. I just want to, like, let people know what the truth is, because, you know, we want to just spread the information. So let me tell you another... Oh.
Nope. So zooming, what else is there?
Thank you, Don, for the prompt. So another example which I'm going to give is the whole cryptography idea. So when you watch 24, Jack uncovers some, like, USB drive that has critical information to national security, and so he sends it over to Chloe, who's, like, the tech person at the counter-terrorist unit, and she goes, oh, Jack, I can't get the information, it's encrypted. And he's like, Chloe, we need that information. She's like, I don't know, Jack, it's hard, it's encrypted. He's like, how long will it take? She's like, oh, maybe 20 minutes. He's like, oh, come on, hurry up, Chloe, we need it in 10 minutes. Like, I'm trying, Jack. Okay, I guess I should stop with the dramatization.
20 minutes? Wow, those are some pretty amazing decryption algorithms.
So the whole study, like, encryption is a really well-studied science, and the whole point of it is to be able to take your information and then, you know, mess with it in such a way that it's impossible to decrypt it, or you would need, like, the time the universe has been around, basically, of computing power in order to get your information back to what you did. So
this sort of thing, like, if you don't have the key, there's no way you're going to get the
but I read in a science magazine once where they talked about quantum computing, where they could be able to crack all these information, and the government must have that somewhere on one of their...
What level conspiracy theory is that?
Well, according to the DWM Institute, this would be a level 3 fallacy, because there's a hint of truth in it, but it's far from
He's
being true.
He's making this up.
Well, maybe they have R2-D2 working for them, and then they can just plug it in.
I think that maybe the bad guys on 24 aren't very smart, and they're using one of those, like, Caesar shift ciphers, which is where, like, all the A's become Q's and all the B's become T's.
You just turn, you know, rotate the alphabet.
But again, going back to, I think, one of the points of this is that there are kernels of truth in some of these things.
It
is sound plausible, but they take it to a ridiculous, and if you just run with it, then you're going to go off the deep end.
There are certain instances in some of these shows where they go completely off the deep end. I recall an episode of CSI where they capture sound off of someone who was they pick up sound that was made in a room where someone was shaping a cylinder out of clay. And somehow, a piece of straw managed to etch sound waves that it was picking up into the clay, much like you would record a wax cylinder or a record. And I'm looking at this, and I'm just like, okay, that's going a little too far.
That kind of sounds like the zoom in and enhance, except for audio. Okay, one last quick example, because Ethan's spinning his finger around. Okay, or maybe there's no time. Yes, there's time. Okay, another interesting example is face recognition, which I think is, like, kind of blow it out of proportion on these shows, because, like, anytime they have any, like, blurry image of someone and they pass into the system, and then right away they're comparing it to their database of images, and right away they know who the bad guy is. So in reality, I guess I won't get too much into it, but in reality, you can't ever have a perfect match. There's always like a probability of whether it's real, whether it's a match or whether it's not a match. There might be multiple matches. So there again, it's like a kernel of truth, like Don says, except at the same time, it's like these systems seem to work way much better than our current technology is able to just match two images of not the same thing.
And on a similar note, sorry, just before we leave the show, I have to get this in about 24 and torture. Sorry. Okay. Torture doesn't work, although 24 seems to think it does. And the fact that Bauer was used as an example of why the American needs to pass the Patriot Act and keep people in Guantanamo shows the influence of fictional shows on real-world decisions.
So there you have it, folks. You can't always assume things you see on 24 is accurate. Well, we're really out of time, so Don, give us a quote.
A quote today is from Francis Wien, who's a philosopher. Irrationality is both cumulative and contagious. You start by reading your horoscope in a newspaper, then you dabble in chakra balancing and feng shui, saying that it's important to keep an open mind. After a while, your mind is so open that your brain falls out, and you read the protocols of the Elders of Zion without noticing anything amiss. So, I think that's a good way to end the show. Everyone here knows what the protocols of Zion are, aren't they?
Maybe just for those of us who don't know, myself not included, perhaps you could just explain.
The protocols of the Elders of Zion was a propaganda document created by the Tsarist government in the mid to late 1800s, which showed about the Jewish conspiracy and how Jews were out to ruin and destroy the world. And it was used as a propaganda tool. But some of these things are still believed in some parts of the world today. And some of the things they believed is that once a month, Jewish men have to go out and kill a young child, Christian child, otherwise they can't reproduce. And stuff like that's in this Elders of Zion. It was total crap. But some people believe it. Again, this shooter at the Holocaust Museum, I bet you he believes that it's true.
Okay, well, that's horrible news. All right then, so we remind our listeners.
On that happy note.
come to Cafe Scientifique today at 6:30.
You could pay $5 and shake my hand.
Yeah, sure.
Or you could pay $0 and shake my hand.
There you go. Shake his hand. Okay. Well, email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com and check out our blog at ubcfreethinkers.blogspot.com.
Make sure Rob washed his hands.
And my name is Ethan. I'm your freethinking historian saying good night.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Elon saying I didn't know that we were supposed to come up with a catchy catchphrase.
Damn it! And this is Rob saying, I forgot what I was going to say, and it was going to be really clever.
Thanks for listening.
Good night.
CITR 101.9 and Discorder Magazine are hosting an epic Canada Day party at the Astoria. Come celebrate 142 years of Confederation featuring Gang Violence, Reflections, MT40, and guest DJs Ian Wyatt and No Gold. Doors are at 10 p.m., show starts at 11. Join us for a night of amazing local sounds at 769 East Hastings, the Astoria, on Wednesday, July 1st.
Time racketeer. Back in full force.
This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Maybe a song from a film or a tune from TV. Radio Free Gak brings you sounds of the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future and the forgotten classics that need a little rescue. Radio Free Gak, Monday evening, 7:30 till 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hi, this is Burt Reynolds. You listen to Wiener's Barbecue, and they're not giving me a damn thing for this.